From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Standing as we are on the precipice of next month's Iowa caucus, you'd think that the good people of Iowa and New Hampshire would be drowning in political advertising. Yet, in comparison with 2007 at least, their airwaves are eerily quiet. Earlier this week, the New York Times reported that for a variety of reasons, including the fact that just Republicans are competing in this year's primaries, ad buys are down in those states. Way down. Campaigns and political groups spent almost $22 million in Iowa by this point in 2007. This year, they've spent only $2.4 million. Instead, it seems free media have filled the void. First among them, the televised debate.
Welcome to the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando, Florida, the site of our Republican presidential debate.
Gingrich, this next one's for you. You've criticized extending unemployment benefits, saying that you are, quote, opposed to giving people money for doing nothing. Benefits have already been extended.
The idea that you stand here before us and talk about that you're strong on immigration is on its face the height of hypocrisy.
The governor says, look, states ought to be able to opt out of Social Security. Our nominee has to be someone who isn't committed to abolishing Social Security, but who's committed to saving Social Security. We have always had at the heart of our party a recognition.
I don't think he knows what he's talking about in that regard.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, a professor and longtime analyst of political media, says you should consume your debates. They're good for you.
When a good reporter does an extended interview with a candidate, you don't simply learn what the candidate wants to tell you. You learn what the candidate tells you after being confronted with tough questions.
Well, the candidates are relentlessly on message. They turn every question, no matter what the topic, back into their set of talking points.
What you learn about Governor Perry when, for an entire debate, he kept moving back to energy policy, no matter what he was asked, was that he may not have the range of expertise required to answer those questions yet. What you learn when the candidates on the Republican stage are asked, would you take 10 times spending cuts to one times tax increase, and they say no, you know the position of the entire Republican field and how it differs from the Obama administration. You know across the debates that these candidates oppose the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which they call Obamacare. You can't learn all of that in advertising.
So do you see any value in political advertising? I mean, in terms of instructing the electorate?
Yes, no question. Advertising in general contains accurate, not inaccurate statements.
I'm surprised.
That's historically true. And I tell you that having spent more hours than I would care to count analyzing claim by claim in the ads. But that doesn't mean that there aren't serious deceptions in them. That's why we need a lot of good journalism wrapped around this political process.
It was interesting. The ratings for the early debates, at least, were pretty high. Were they higher than usual?
We tend to have higher attention to politics when the nation feels anxious. Also, when they're unhappy with the incumbent.
But the ratings have lagged.
They tend to over time. But the fact that we had the early spike and that we have respectable ongoing levels is good news. Candidates focused, for example, in one debate solely on foreign policy, another debate solely on economic matters. Your level of knowledge about these candidates has risen substantially if you've paid even reasonable attention.
You know, the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision has resulted in a Mount Everest of cash. What do you think led us to this moment where money is not dominating the media environment?
The opportunity to participate in the debates early said to candidates, I can reach my intended audience without expending ad dollars. You would not have seen Speaker Gingrich emerge as a candidate or Mr. Kaine emerge as a candidate. Both of those candidacies driven by debate performances, they weren't doing very much advertising. In fact, in Gingrich's case, he wasn't doing any.
Well, these are glorious days for democracy.
Well, let's just say better than some others.
Doesn't it have something to do with the fact that there were so many GOP candidates that people were keeping their money off the table?
No, we've had this number in fields before. I think what was accounting for it is the fact that you had the venues and they were attracting the audience.
Are you expecting an explosion of advertising in the coming months?
Yes. We're going to see so much advertising that you will turn on the Golf Channel and find ads. You'll turn on your channels that ordinarily would never see a political presence, and there they will be. Indeed, they're going to have to figure out how to put money into advertising on people's backs in order to spend all of their money.
You know, you talk a lot about interviews, but these are GOP candidates. And where we've seen the preponderance of interviews is on Fox News. Do you really think that the public is getting bang for that particular buck?
This week, we saw extended interviews by Wolf Blitzer on CNN of Governor Perry and of Speaker Gingrich. Good, tough questions, very clear follow-up. Governor Perry's answers, for example, on Israel are going to create real controversy.
Certainly, Bret Baier got into a tussle with Romney on Fox News.
That was a good interview by Bret Baier. You also saw a very strong interview by Bill O'Reilly of Governor Perry the week that Governor Perry had put up an ad that took out of context a statement by President Obama. In the ad, Governor Perry says that President Obama says Americans are lazy. Bill O'Reilly said that wasn't what he's referring to, was it? Wasn't he referring to government agencies? He also asked him to defend his position that President Obama is a socialist. I think that we ought to be open to the possibility that Fox journalistic norms will hold Republican candidates accountable, and those of us who may not be inclined to watch Fox might be well served by watching those interviews.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is the head of the Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and director of Fact Check and the new website FlackCheck.org.
Jamieson is not alone in detecting a new, tougher approach to GOP candidates from Fox News Channel. Gabriel Sherman, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, says the less kind, less gentle interviewing of Republican hopefuls is in part a marketing strategy conceived by Fox News chairman and CEO Roger Ailes.
What Roger Ailes has successfully done is allowed this Republican primary to take place almost entirely on Fox News. The candidates show up in the morning on Fox and Friends. They do interviews during the day. They appear in the prime time at night. They've allowed candidates a platform to air their proposals, critics would say without scrutiny, but they've also knocked them around.
For Fox News to move center, it first has to have been on the right. The daily marching orders from editorial management, previously John Moody, now Bill Salmon, has been in lockstep with the messaging of the Republican National Committee. And these are marching orders not for the punditry, but for the news side of the organization.
From my sources at the network, Bill Salmon's presence has been very controversial. And in fact, there's journalists inside Fox News who have been uncomfortable with Salmon's hands-on and unsubtle attempts to steer coverage rightward. This gets to the heart of what the network is trying to do now. For a bit of context, it's really important to look at the fact that prior to the Obama election, Fox News's ratings were down considerably. And so, you know, Roger Ailes looked at the landscape in 2008 and said, what can I do to re-energize conservatives and increase ratings on my network? And he hired a whole stable of former Republican candidates and politicians. Those decisions created an environment where Fox News tapped into this populist fervor that was sweeping the country, and ratings exploded. Fox News became an active participant in the storyline that was developing from 2008 through the 2010 midterms, that there was this populist, anti-government, anti-Obama movement sweeping the country that achieved what Roger Ailes had wanted, which was to revive the network and dominate the cable news ratings race, which translates into roughly about $1 billion in profit annually.
What changed his mind and made him drift at least in the direction of the center?
The short answer is Roger Ailes couldn't control Glenn Beck. In the opening months of the Obama presidency, Glenn Beck's ratings exploded from roughly about 1 million to over 2 million. Glenn Beck's no longer on the network. I think Ailes realized that Glenn Beck was becoming the public face of Fox News. He needed to remind both his audience and the rest of the media that Fox News was not Glenn Beck.
So this journalism offensive has manifested itself recently in an interview with Republican Mitt Romney, in which anchor Bret Baier, on health care, having, as a governor of Massachusetts, instituted a health care program much like Fox boogeyman Obamacare.
Do you still support the idea of a mandate? Do you believe that that was the right thing for Massachusetts? Do you think a mandate, mandating people to buy insurance, is the right tool?
Brett, I don't know how many hundred times I've said this too. This is an unusual interview. All right, let's do it again. Absolutely. What we did in Massachusetts was right for Massachusetts. I've said that time and time again.
Brett Baer told Bill O'Reilly in a subsequent follow-up interview that Romney said he thought his questions were overly aggressive and uncalled for. Now, it's also fascinating to see that Fox News, which is a very difficult institution to penetrate, allowed Howard Kurtz of Newsweek to roam around and interview their producers at a debate in Orlando. And recently, at a Fox News forum in Manhattan, allowed Jim Rutenberg of the New York Times to roam around backstage. And it was another embarrassing moment for the Romney campaign because they tried to shield Romney from the Times reporter.
So the front-runner Republican candidate goes into what he thinks is the Citadel and finds out that it is in no way a safe haven. What is Ailes up to?
It's important to look at Fox News as a product packaged and sold every day to millions of people. Coming out of the 2010 midterms, Fox News realized that its product was potentially liable for the incendiary rhetoric that was making its way onto the channel, and that they needed to rebrand themselves. That is why you're seeing the New York Times allowed to interview Republican primary candidates in a venue that no journalist would get access to.
What can go wrong?
A lot can go wrong. Fox faces a risk if they push this idea that they are moving to the middle too far. They could alienate their conservative base that has been such a foundation of their rating success.
Fantastic, Gabe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gabriel Sherman is a contributing editor for New York Magazine.
Coming up, live streaming is the modern activist's weapon of choice.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we've noted before on the show, even though the 250,000 confidential State Department cables leaked last year by WikiLeaks have long been public, they are still officially confidential. Last spring, the American Civil Liberties Union filed under the Freedom of Information Act for copies of cables dealing with such issues as Guantanamo, rendition, and torture. And the State Department responded by offering redacted documents as if the truth were not, as it were, already out there. It's a charade that the ACLU decided to highlight by making a little mischief. Ben Wisner is the litigation director for the ACLU's National Secrecy Project.
The idea was to force the government to go through the declassification process and to see which of many uncomfortable responses they would come up with. Would they release the documents in full in accordance with common sense? Would they withhold them in full and look silly? Would they redact them and essentially give us a roadmap to what they think is important and sensitive information and what is not? Remarkably, they chose the third option.
The most revealing one.
In a sense, it is. That's right. 12 of the documents, they said, had to be withheld in full. 11, they gave us redacted versions. And so we have a unique window into the government's classification process.
And just for people who haven't seen a redacted document, that's where chunks of it are blacked out. You can't see through it. It looks a little like Swiss cheese.
Well, that's right. And what we've done at ACLU.org is put up the redacted documents. But when your cursor hovers over the redacted portion, the text magically appears. And so we get to see what the government would prefer that the world not know. So in a discussion with foreign governments, you might see unredacted all of the subjects of agreement, and then the censor's pen will come out when that government is criticizing U.S. policy. policy on rendition, on torture, on Guantanamo, or the like.
So what you've got is essentially a teachable moment, and you give people who visit your site an opportunity to experience the childhood joys of invisible ink.
Well, it's that, and it's a little bit more. So although there is something cheeky about asking for something that we already have, we're hoping to illuminate what is a serious issue in the way that the government abuses its secrecy privilege. The whole secrecy regime is really predicated on the asserted distinction between what is universally known and what's officially acknowledged. The fact that the whole world has access to these documents means nothing to the government and means nothing to a court until the moment that the government acknowledges them. So that the government can, for example, off the record, brag to reporters about the wonderful successes of their targeted killing drone strike program. But when we file a request under FOIA to get documents about that, they can refuse to confirm or deny the existence of that program. When we file a lawsuit seeking to set legal limits on that program, they can invoke the state secrets privilege over information that is known but not confirmed. And so the idea here is not just to have these documents, but to be able to use them. And by putting the government through the exercise of declassification, our hope was to move this from being known to being acknowledged.
Ben, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Ben Wisner is the litigation director of the ACLU's National Security Project. We'll feature some before and after shots of those documents on our website, onthemedia.org, and we'll also offer links to the ACLU's project. Live streaming, the act of broadcasting a video to the internet in close to real time, is quickly becoming a staple tool of 21st century protesters. From Occupy Wall Street to the Egyptian election last week to the Russian election this week, activists use cell phones as weapons of transparency, not only documenting but broadcasting events as they happen. Bamboozer is a live streaming mobile app out of Sweden with more than 2 million downloads. Mans Adler is co-founder of Bamboozer. He also trains activists in its use. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
A lot of people think of live streaming as a paragon of objectivity. Is this really the case?
No, but it's definitely much harder to fake. I mean, it has the potential of validating things that a lot of other tools have a hard time of validating. Since Twitter is only text, it's very hard for a news editor to validate if someone writes that there is 100,000 people on Tahrir Square at the moment. However, if they are live streaming, then a news editor will be able to send a real-time chat saying, can you broadcast to the right? And they will validate that this is going on right here, right now.
You founded Bamboozer in 2007. What motivated you then?
The vision was to democratize the technology of broadcasting. The traditional business model for broadcasting video costs several dollars a second. All of a sudden, you had everything on your phone. You had a camera. You had an internet connection. And boom, all of a sudden, you could do the same with your mobile phone.
How was the technology first applied?
There were soccer moms streaming live from soccer games. There were people handing out real-time live lectures, so students away from the university could ask questions and interact. A lot of nonprofit organizations picked up the tool here in Sweden. A lot of the political parties started to do press conferences, and it sort of moved over during the last years to more activists. Live streaming provides them the opportunity to not be afraid of losing their content. Because in scenarios where you're protesting and police may confiscate your phones, doing a live stream, the content is already out there on the web.
Have you seen any of the live streaming translate into tangible results?
We have several scenarios of this. For example, a guy that we actually met in Egypt, Tarek Shalabi, he was live streaming a protest outside the Israeli embassy in the beginning of June. He got arrested together with 12 other people. He kept on streaming while the police were arresting them. He even managed to get his phone into his pocket before they took it away from him. You can hear everything they say. And they were actually collaborating with the Egyptian army, which was the first time anybody heard that.
In Egypt, there is loyalty towards the army and a great deal of hostility towards the police. So this would seem like a betrayal.
Exactly. And so this live stream were picked up by Al Jazeera, and it was such a huge thing on the news, even before the police had managed to get those 13 people to the police station. So the head of the police station, so afraid of all the media attacking him, he just say, we have to let them go.
By the time they got to the station, there was so much media clamor that they were released?
Exactly.
Wow, that's fast work. What is the relationship between news outlets and this live streaming?
A lot of news outlets pick up our videos, use it around their websites or even in their traditional broadcasting scenarios. We have deals with all the public broadcasters in Scandinavia and also a couple of the private ones. When the bomb exploded in Oslo in 22nd of July this year, there was a person starting a live broadcast, and what the bomb had taken out, and that video was directly picked up by the Danish national broadcaster. So it took 4 minutes from he started his broadcast until that broadcast was live on the television in Denmark.
Do you have a record of everyone who downloads Bamboozer?
Everybody who registered an account, we can sort of see what kind of email address they have used, but that's about it.
I wanted to ask you, because I wondered whether you're seeing a trend that might predict where the next set of public protests may be occurring.
We're receiving a lot of videos from Russia, Syria, from the Emirates that many don't know about. And of course, a lot of Occupy Wall Street movements.
So in a way, this live streaming provides a portrait of protest.
Absolutely. It's sort of like taking the temperature on a political level on what's going on our planet right here, right now.
Måns, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Måns Adler is the co-founder of the live streaming video platform Bamboozer.
Malaysia is another country struggling to tamp down on information run amok. Dozens of newspapers, magazines, nearly 10 different TV stations, and even more radio serve this nation of 28 million. An abundance of media due in no small part to Malaysia's multicultural, multilingual status. Roughly 60% of the population speaks Malay, the national language. 30% are Chinese who speak any number of dialects, and 10% are Indian who mostly speak Tamil. Each group has a range of media in its native tongue, and often members of different ethnicities can't understand each other. But as OTM producer Jamie York reports, they share one notable detail, and that is...
And that is utter, unthreatening, unctuous blandness.
The NASA group of companies has added U.S.-based Tutti Frutti frozen yogurt to its food and beverage division.
And here's something that's sure to entice your taste buds. Time Out magazine has identified 18 best restaurants in Kuala Lumpur.
Icon is an optometry network by current eye care practitioners from every state in Malaysia who believe that the way forward is in branding.
That blandness is because they're all governed by a near-perfect form of government censorship. But near is not complete. And there lies the beginning of a tale. In 2010, Reporters Without Borders ranked Malaysia 141st in press freedom out of 178 countries, in the same company as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Pakistan.
And there was quite a bit of hoo-ha because Malaysia is ranked lower than Singapore. Malaysians were a bit upset about that.
Masjaliza Hamza, a former reporter who runs the Center for Independent Journalism, says that when it comes to censorship, Malaysians' competitiveness outweighs their cynicism.
Not so much that they've consistently been ranked in the lower one-third. That wasn't an issue. The issue was that Singapore was ranked higher than we were.
Reporters who overstep their bounds get the call from government officials or notes about what they may not discuss. And Malaysian media outlets must be annually licensed by the government. Those licenses can be yanked if you offend this Islamic State.
Recently, with the controversies surrounding cartoon images of the Prophet Muhammad.
Zaharam Nain is a journalist turned journalism professor.
One newspaper in East Malaysia covered that story, unfortunately had a photograph of someone reading the original newspaper with a cartoon. And it wasn't even a Malaysian, it was someone outside. It was a syndicated photograph. And because they used that photograph, the newspapers closed down and many journalists lost their jobs.
And if all else fails, there's the Internal Security Act, or ISA, which
allows the government of the day to arrest and detain without trial anybody that they want, indefinitely. That fear is very real among a lot of journalists who are opposed to the policies and the ways of the state.
The government of the day, as Naeem calls it, is composed almost exclusively of members of the Malay majority. It is, to put it mildly, interested in keeping it that way. But a funny thing happened on the way to total government censorship. In 1997, Malaysia's then Prime Minister, Mahathir bin Mohamad, saw the potential for something called the internet, to take Malaysia from an agricultural economy to one where fledgling online companies could set up shop. All they needed was a super corridor to the internet and an environment conducive to invention and experimentation. Maharam Nain.
You didn't need to go through the high technology phase. You could just leap into the whole cyber era.
But only if Malaysia could attract creative entrepreneurs. And you know how they are.
Creative people can be a bit funny. Yeah, they need certain freedoms. And if they don't have those freedoms, they're going to be running off to other countries. Which is why he designed the Bill of Guarantees that there would be no censorship of the internet.
So Prime Minister Mahathir blithely punched a huge hole in the information dam Malaysia had so carefully constructed. Maybe he thought that the internet penetration was so low in Malaysia that no one but the corporate sector would ever use it. Maybe he figured economic development trumped the risks of uncensored news. In any case, Stephen Gann was a frustrated print reporter who saw that opening and walked right through it.
That's where the loophole was for us. We can just call ourselves content provider, sell our website, and off we go. We decided that perhaps it'd be good if you have a website that provides a credible source of information to everybody, that it is run by professional journalists, that the stories are checked and double-checked, they meet that professional standard.
Gann and a co-founder called their site Malaysia Kini, or Malaysia Today, and they set about reporting all the things they'd never been able to cover.
Independence of the judiciary, we've been reporting about police abuses, brutality, deaths in custody, anything that's critical of government, government policy on human rights. We saw our readership grew from, say, 500 to about 10,000 within weeks, and then went up as high as 300,000.
Somehow, and everyone has a theory, the government underestimated the internet until it was too late to rein it back in. Nain says it's a bit like firefighting.
They're so far behind that, you know, the fire's already spread. They're trying to catch up, but it's kind of difficult to do that. So I think they just screwed it up.
In the last 12 years, the internet has gradually reached 70% of Malaysians. Online news sites have proliferated, and there's this.
They were told not to come, but they came anyway, and confrontations between pro-reform demonstrators and police turned violent on the streets of Kuala Lumpur, precisely what the government said it wanted to avoid by banning the demonstrations in the first place.
Public engagement has coalesced into larger and louder public protests. This summer, approximately 50,000 people turned out in the streets of Malaysia's biggest city, Kuala Lumpur, calling for free and fair elections, or Bersih, for clean. Mainstream media inveighed against the march, but tens of thousands of people protested anyway. And Stephen Gann believes his site, Malaysia Kini, actually played a significant part.
On that day alone, we have 5 million hits.
In 2008's national election, the ruling party lost its two-thirds parliamentary majority, despite complete control over the election process and all of the traditional media. It was unprecedented. Obviously, change was inevitable. But Malaysia's online media was suffering the same problem as nearly every media outlet the world over. No money. Does democracy in Malaysia rise and fall based on a viable business model? Stephen Gann.
Making political impact wasn't our biggest worry. Though, of course, in the beginning, we worry about that. Trying to make sure that we make enough money to keep the operation going. That's our major worry.
Malaysia Kini has had to erect a paywall an extremely difficult choice to make when you're the shining example of freedom of information. And then there's the thornier question of whether information alone is ever a catalyst for change. Nain is skeptical of what he calls technological determinism.
In the 60s, for example, there was this belief that television would help develop the developing countries, right? And it didn't in many ways. This whole notion that liberation depends on technological form, to me, is problematic.
Despite Malaysia Keeney's success, Gan also remains circumspect.
I always argue that if Malaysia is to change, it will require three main ingredients. One will be independent media, two will be a strong opposition, and three will be a vibrant civil society.
In just the last 2 years since the ruling party lost its total lock on power, the government has been using the mainstream media to inflame old ethnic and religious divides. Malay versus the Chinese, everyone versus the Malay, etc. The old colonial strategy of divide and rule. Gan takes some bitter satisfaction in that, both in that the government is back on its heels and that its critics can comment on it in a space the government inadvertently created, online. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
Jamie's story was reported from Malaysia on a fellowship from the International Reporting Project.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. Constant Contact, offering email marketing tools to promote small businesses during the holiday season. Learn more at constantcontact.com. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Over Thanksgiving weekend, the Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, seized 150 domain names of websites allegedly selling counterfeit goods. It's the latest salvo in ICE's ongoing campaign to shutter sites that infringe on copyrights or sell counterfeits. ICE can seize a domain name without an injunction or even an accusation of wrongdoing, but only ones that end with .com or .org, since those are registered in the United States. Now, sites across the globe with no legal recourse are being forced to change their names. But one site is fighting back. A Spanish sports forum website called RojaDirecta.com claims that it was seized in February not because it hosted infringing material, but because some of its more than 800,000 users linked to video streams that did violate copyright. So Roja Directa's parent company, Puerto Ochenta, is suing the U.S. to get its domain back. Lawyer Mark Lemley represents Puerto Ochenta. He says that under current law, it's not clear if ICE actually has the authority to do what it's doing.
The government is using what it calls the civil forfeiture authority. So if a government charges you with a crime, say you're dealing drugs out of your car, the government has the ability to seize the drugs and to seize your car because you were using it to commit a crime. So what the government here is saying is a website is being used to facilitate the commission of a crime, criminal copyright infringement, and so the government can seize and shut down an internet domain name.
Why is Customs Enforcement, the Department of Homeland Security, doing this?
The rationale, I suppose, is that this is a foreign website, and so the information that comes across the internet is being imported into the United States. Although, to be honest, I would have thought that ICE had more important things to deal with than playing rent-a-cop for the entertainment industry.
Doesn't the Digital Millennium Copyright Act actually hold third-party sites harmless for potentially infringing content that they did not themselves place on the site?
Yes, in the United States, but my client is in Spain and different rules apply.
Okay, now let's get to the central element of your argument, and that is that the seizure of these domain names is the equivalent of breaking into a newspaper plant and confiscating the presses.
There are two basic points. One is, by seizing the entire domain name, the government is by definition shutting down not just whatever infringing material is there, but also the material which everyone agrees is non-infringing, forum discussions about soccer teams and the like. And second, the government hasn't yet proven that there's infringing material on the site. And the First Amendment, under the doctrine of prior restraint, says you don't get to shut down speech in advance of a hearing in which a court decides whether or not that speech is unprotected.
So when the Nixon administration tried to prevent the Washington Post and the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers, the Supreme Court said, not so fast. You cannot preemptively shut down protected speech.
And there what the government was trying to do was block one article. Here, the equivalent of what the government is trying to do would be to say, ah, the New York Times has engaged in facilitating a criminal act, the disclosure of national security secrets. So we'll seize the New York Times as a whole.
Now, we began this conversation with a discussion about the murky underlying law behind customs seizures. There is a bill, actually a couple of them, I believe, pending in Congress that would create the statutory authority for a government agency to act.
There are bills pending now in the Senate. It goes under the name Protect IP Act, and in the House it goes under the name SOPA, or the Stop Online Piracy Act, that would perhaps create statutory authority for what the government is already doing, and it would also expand that authority. So those bills would give customs enforcers the power to seize not just domain names located in the United States, the .com or .org domains, but even to go after domains located entirely abroad. And if they could get a court order, even a temporary one, to declare them to be foreign infringing websites, they would then go to every internet service provider, every credit card company, every search engine, and every advertiser, and say, you must stop dealing with these people. Even if people type in the domain or the IP address, you can't route traffic to those domains. So they would essentially ban those sites from the internet.
I can only imagine the First Amendment ramifications of those acts.
You could think of this, I think, as the sort of great firewall of America. China has an effort to block websites that it considers dangerous, like Facebook or Twitter. It makes it awfully hard for us to say to countries around the world, hey, you shouldn't be censoring the internet. Countries are simply going to say, well, you censor the internet when the internet includes something that you don't like.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Mark Lemley is director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology. The Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement declined our request for comment, saying that it is, quote, precluded from commenting on cases pending before the court. Last month, the Second United Nations-backed tribunal began trying leaders of the Cambodian Khmer Rouge, the radical communist regime accused of committing torture and genocide between 1975 and 1979. An estimated 1.7 million people were murdered, close to a quarter of the population at the time. But in the decades since, only one man has been tried and convicted for those crimes. Tet Sombat has been trying to change that. An investigative journalist for Cambodia's largest paper, he spent 10 years befriending and gently coaxing dozens of confessions from those he suspected were guilty. His crowning achievement, an apology on camera from Nun Chia, the second in command of the Khmer Rouge, the highest-ranking person now on trial. Sombat's film, Enemies of the People, is his attempt to explain the past to a generation of Cambodians who widely refused to believe that such brutality was perpetrated by their forebears.
Because all the Khmer Rouge kept quiet, did not tell the people. When any journalist went to talk to the top Khmer Rouge leader, especially Lai Nun Chia, he always denied any killing.
You spent years ingratiating yourself with Nun Chia, softening him up, before he was candid with you. as a reporter, was it frustrating to invest literally years to get him to speak the truth?
At the beginning, yes, I had to be patient a lot. Because if I just go one time, 3 times, 10 times to get it, it is impossible. I take 4 years that he start to tell everything, yes. I just try to go to see him every weekend.
You drove from Phnom Penh to the north of the country every weekend for 4 years. Years of patience, as you say. But it also took you years of silence because of not what you asked Nun Chia, but of what you didn't tell him.
I didn't tell him about my family members, especially my mother, my father and brother died during the time, because if I told him, Nun Chia would stop talking to me because he thought that I am not neutral. I try to keep my background very secret. Even my wife, my children, I never told them about my family member died during the Khmer Rouge, because I am worried that my wife or my children can leak this information outside. And then other people, especially like Nun Chia and other Khmer Rouge, they know about this problem and then they would stop talking to me. Until at the end, I decided to tell Nun Chia because I saw that the court was going to arrest Nun Chia, and then I tell him about that. Even Nun Chia, he's surprised about when I told him, because when I am talking with Nun Chia, we are very friendly to each other.
You know, there was a film by Quentin Tarantino released about the time that Enemies of the People was released, called Inglourious Basterds. And one of the characters in the film, her family was murdered by the Nazis, and she finds herself dining a year or so later with the murderer. It's very dramatic, it's very tense, but it was fiction. Watching you in this film, sitting down and smiling with brother number two and his family, it's a chilling thing to witness.
At the beginning, yes, when I talk to Nun Chia and other killer, it makes my heart is not so good. Especially when I talk to the killer, they always talk about how they kill the people, how they cut, the way they kill my father is similar. And then make me very sad, but I just keep quiet.
You told a New York Times reporter that you came to like Nun Chia.
I met Nun Chia, I talked Nun Chia. More frequently, I talk to my brother, my sister, yes? So even Nun Chia, he also talked a lot to me, more than his relative. He didn't tell his children about what's happening during that time. Even his children are surprised why his father told me, didn't tell them anything. If Nun Chia died, I think the Khmer Rouge story finished.
The story resides only in the memories of Nun Chia. Pol Pot has been dead for years.
Nun Chia and Pol Pot, they are the same person. I talked to Nun Chia, he said, if Pol Pot still alive, I will took him to see you and both of us will talk to you.
Sambat, I asked you about that fictional film, Inglourious Basterds, for a reason. The character who sat quietly with her family's murderer did so because she was looking for revenge. But you seem not to have had that motivation. When the United Nations Tribunal asked you for your raw tape to help them with their prosecution, you said no, that you wanted your film not to be prosecutorial evidence, but historical evidence.
I do not need to get them 10 years, 30 years, or 100 years in jail. What I want is let them confess. Because when the killer and Nun Chia, they confess everything, it means that they accept their punishment already, yes? And they want to say apologize to all Cambodian victims.
What was the reaction in Cambodia to your film?
Some Cambodian, they asked me to arrange to meet the killer. I said, why you want to meet them? They said, I want to go and hug them and to say, yeah, I forgive them.
Why would they want to hug these people that were murderers?
They want to hug them because these people, they confess. And then the victim, they understand, oh, these people, they also under oppression, pressure from other Khmer Rouge leaders that order them to kill. If they do not follow the order, they would be killed too. They pity these people.
Sambat, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you to you too, yes.
Tet Sambat is director of Enemies of the People and a reporter at the Phnom Penh Post.
Today, repressive governments routinely censor films they think will incite violence or overly enlighten their citizens. Susan Deitch's new novel, Paper Conspiracies, is set in part during what may be the earliest example of a government censoring a movie. The government was France, and the movie Georges Méliès' 1899, The Dreyfus Affair. It was banned for 50 years and not seen again in France until 1974. The 13-minute silent film was the first docudrama reenacting the tribulations of Army Captain Alfred Dreyfus, falsely convicted of treason and railroaded by the military to protect the real culprit, Major Ferdinand Esterhazy. Ultimately, doctored and suppressed evidence, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia landed Dreyfus in Devil's Island, where he spent years in solitary confinement under wretched conditions. In the waning years of 19th century France, where you stood on Alfred Dreyfus said everything about your view of the world. Méliès' film caused a riot. This was an era flooded with new media, photography, fast printing presses, movies, which were easy to manipulate. So, says Susan Deitch, people chose to believe whatever they liked.
There was also a tremendous generational jump in literacy. And it worked both to support the Dreyfus case and also to condemn him. Both sides used and altered the media.
The movie was produced in 1899 about historical events that had transpired between 1893 and 1899. Is that the first time that's happened?
Yes, the Dreyfus Affair was the first recreation based on photographs and illustrations in weekly newspapers in France at the time. It was an enormous departure for Georges Méliès, who had previously only made magical, fantastic films.
You wrote in your novel, Méliès was an adored man. He offered escape hatches, transformations, jokes. No one wants to see what they can see every day, he said. They want to see what they can't see. Then he began to think about filming what everybody looked at but didn't see. And so what was it that people didn't see about the Dreyfus Affair?
Dreyfus's innocence. During the second trial, which occurred in 1899, after Esterhazy, the actual spy, confessed, Dreyfus was convicted a second time. That was when Méliès made the film, and to show that Dreyfus was, in fact, innocent, that this was all a constructed case against him.
Now, we don't see in the film invented evidence. What we simply see is a man who is driven from pillar to post, from the penal colony, back to trial, clapped in irons?
Dreyfus's brother, Matthew, published a letter in the press that Dreyfus had escaped from Devil's Island because he thought Dreyfus was being forgotten. And in fact, he didn't escape. As a result of that, he was put in irons. Both sides used and altered the media. They would publish constructed photographs where, for example, one of Dreyfus's lawyers and maybe the editor of a far-right press, you would have a photograph of them meeting when, in fact, they had never met.
So the film was banned for 50 years.
It wasn't until 1974 when a film that was going to be on television wanted to include some of the footage from the Méliès film that President Giscard d'Estaing lifted the ban.
That was the end of the ban on making films about Dreyfus. Why did it take so long?
I think it shone a very uncomfortable light on an event that involved a lot of serious mistakes. It wasn't the only film about the Dreyfus trial to be banned in France. The Academy Award-winning 1938 film, The Life of Emile Zola, was also banned in France.
In the name of the people of France, Alfred Dreyfus is condemned to deportation for life. The court-martial also orders that prior to the sentence being carried out, said Captain Dreyfus shall be paraded before the garrison of Paris, there publicly degraded and dismissed from the service.
What was it about the case that split the country so sharply?
Dreyfus was a very potent symbol for opposing ideologies. He was partly also a symbol of what was called the syndicate, the Jewish syndicate that was behind everything that was wrong, the threat of the foreign.
It's interesting. This movie was banned from France. You can watch it today on YouTube.
Yes, anybody with a computer can watch it anywhere in the world, anytime.
And it's almost meaningless. Did the censors win?
No, I don't think so. You know, as long as we remember the story behind the film. And I think also it's important to think about what it meant for Méliès, that he was not just this magician, which was wonderful. His magical films are wonderful, but that he had this kind of moment of conscience.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Deitch is the author of Paper Conspiracies.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, BJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Doug Anderson, Lina Anwar, and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.